Dogfights in the 21st century, Russian fighter jets, and an American drone. Wider crisis averted this time.
The question is really, are cooler heads always going to prevail, particularly as tensions continue to rise and communication between the sides continues to diminish?
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, supply shortages in Ghana are disrupting deliveries of routine vaccines. It puts babies at risk for diseases that have mostly been eradicated. New moms stress while waiting for vaccines to show up.
Then they say we should wait and then see if it will come, maybe next month or so. So I'll try, keep trying.
And hanging out with the young generation in Baghdad. Many of them have fled years of violence and chaos, but others who stayed are bullish about where Iraq is headed.
I want to be part of the success of this country.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A modern-day dogfight over Ukraine's Black Sea coast yesterday. Pentagon officials say Russian fighter jets dumped fuel on a U.S. reconnaissance drone to disrupt its flight. Then, they allege, one of the Russian warplanes clipped the propeller of the U.S. drone, forcing its operators to crash land it. This afternoon, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin called Russia's actions reckless. Austin spoke on the phone with his counterpart in Moscow and says he told him that Russia needs to operate its aircraft in a safe and professional manner.
As I've said repeatedly, it's important that great powers be models of transparency and communication.
The Kremlin says the U.S. drone was conducting unacceptable activities and heading toward Russia. RAND Corporation analyst Samuel Cherup has analyzed dozens of close-shave incidents. I asked him if he thought the incident was intentional or accidental.
It was likely certainly intentional that the Russians wanted to force the Reaper drone to either change course or move from where it was. The question remains as to whether the actual collision itself was accidental or intentional. And here, from what we know from what U.S. officials are saying, it seems like that part might have been accidental. In other words, the Russians intended to sort of harass and increase the potential for a collision, but not actually have one. And the collision itself probably was not in their plans.
So your assessment of yesterday's incident was Russia basically miscalculated its intimidating procedure, and then the U.S. drone got clipped and U.S. drone operators downed it. Is it your understanding that they downed it to avoid the Russian military capturing it?
That part is not clear yet, and it's likely that the pilot was trying to go for a close pass, but made a slight error and actually hit the U.S. drone. So I think there's probably some human error involved here because, you know, if the Russians wanted to down the drone, they could have shot it down quite easily. We've seen that happen, for example, during the Georgia War in 2008. But here they ended up, you know, damaging one of their own fighters. What I would say is that the broader intention of creating risk for the U.S. operators was clearly intentional, that there was a sort of an effort undertaken to use military signaling to basically suggest, if you come around this area near Crimea, you're going to encounter Russian fighter jets and that we will create risk for you, so you better think twice.
Gotcha. The whole episode does seem to raise the stakes for future U.S. drone flights. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said today the U.S. won't stop surveillance flights. But in the long term, Sam, how do you think the U.S. will respond and recalculate the risks?
So I imagine that what Secretary Austin said is likely to prove true, that the U.S. will continue to fly reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea in international airspace, because there's a lot to be observed about, you know, going on, even that the Russians are actively at war. Ukraine is a long coastline. There's probably going to be questions asked about where exactly this took place. You know, whether it was where the flight went that was the source of the increased Russian response. But I don't expect, you know, the U.S. to be dramatically dialing back its surveillance activities because of this incident.
I mean, no doubt the White House is looking at this carefully because this incident happened so close to a hot war, and that always presents the risk of inadvertent escalation. What is the worst case scenario of what this could set in motion?
You know, I think that the challenge of a Russian military, particularly that is under high stress, actively engaged in a war now for over a year, and could do things that force a response from either the U.S. or its allies that could, you know, spiral out of control. Neither Russia nor NATO member states, including the United States, want to go to war with one another, but they're both operating in such close proximity that the chance for inadvertent episodes to escalate out of control and produce an outcome that neither side intended is much greater than it would be in peacetime. The question is really, are cooler heads always going to prevail, particularly as tensions continue to rise and communication between the sides continues to diminish?
Samuel Cherup is a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Thanks for being with us, Sam. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Markham.
For the first time, a pro-abortion activist in Europe has been sentenced for providing abortion pills to a pregnant woman. Justyna Wędrzeńska was sentenced to 8 months of community service in a Polish court yesterday. Poland has some of the strictest anti-abortion laws in Europe, and human rights campaigners fear other countries in Europe may follow Poland's lead. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has been following the trial. Orla, remind us how this case unfolded.
Yeah, so back in February of 2020, Justyna Wędrzeńska got a call from an abortion support helpline saying that a woman in Poland had contacted them, saying she was pregnant, that her husband was being very abusive, and she was looking to access an abortion. The woman, she's known only as Anya. She had already tried to go to Germany to have an abortion, and her husband stopped her. And it's illegal in Poland to send abortion pills to someone who is pregnant. So all organizations like Justyna's can do is send women information on how to get an abortion or how to access the pills from abroad. But Justyna said she felt very sorry for the woman. She knew she was in a desperate situation. And Justyna herself was in an abusive relationship some years back and had an abortion as well at the time. So she said this woman, Anya's case, kind of rang true for her. She had abortion pills herself at home, Justyna said. So she sent them in an envelope to this woman's address. But the husband saw the package, took the package, contacted the police. And then months later, the police turned up at Justina's door. She was later then charged with helping a woman to access an abortion.
What was the expectation with the trial? Did Justyna Wędrzeńska believe that she would be found guilty and sentenced yesterday?
Well, she said she hoped she wouldn't. She said yesterday after the trial verdict that she was very disappointed. But I spoke with Mara Clark this afternoon, who has supported Justyna through the trial. Mara is co-founder of the group SAFE, which is an organisation that organises financial help for women looking to access abortion in Europe. And I asked her how Justyna was doing today.
Justyna is exhausted, as we all are who do this work. But you know, this isn't going to stop her. This isn't going to stop the Abortion Dream Team. The whole push behind this campaign was that behind every Justyna, there's 10 more of us, and then 10 more people behind each of us. And they're going to have to come for all of us.
8 months community service for Justyna Wędrzeńska. What kind of reaction have you been hearing in Poland to this sentencing, as well as elsewhere?
Yeah, interesting. Pro-abortion activists in Poland today were saying they think the sentencing and the lightness of the sentence could be politically motivated, because they said that perhaps the judge was thinking a light sentence will not cause unrest on the streets of Poland. As we've seen, there's been huge protests in Poland over the last few years because of the government's crackdown on abortion laws. And of course, there has been concern about the independence of the judiciary in Poland in recent years. There were some on the left, Polish politicians, who tweeted their support for Justyna yesterday. But there are a lot of politicians also on the right who want the law to be made even stricter. And at the moment, aside from Malta, Poland has the strictest anti-abortion laws in Europe. But there was a debate in the Polish parliament just last week, Marco, on a new bill to criminalise people for giving out information on abortion. Now, it was rejected by parliament, but some lawmakers do want abortion to be outlawed in all circumstances. So what some of the support groups are saying today is that they worry that anti-abortion activists in other parts of Europe, that they will be watching what's happening in Poland, and they might put pressure on their own governments to change the laws, in particular in countries like Hungary. They worry that the law may be made stricter there. Or in Italy, the new Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, when she came into power, she said she didn't plan at the time on banning abortion, but she is in favour of restricting it. So they worry that Poland might kind of be used by campaigners, anti-abortion campaigners in those countries, put pressure on their own governments. But there is a rally outside the Polish embassy in London tonight in support of Justyna. And I imagine we'll see more of that in the coming days before any appeal hearing is heard.
Orla Barry is our Europe correspondent. Thanks very much for the update, Orla.
You're welcome, Marco.
The number of migrants arriving at the southern border of the U.S. seeking asylum is still near record highs. Other countries in the Western Hemisphere are seeing the same. Chile, for example, is reporting an unprecedented number of migrants. In response, Chile's government is sending the army to its northern border. The world's TBS Isaiah has more on that.
Cities across northern Chile have seen large numbers of migrants arriving in the past couple of years. Most of them are from Venezuela, but some come from Haiti and other Latin American countries. Pilar Lizana is with a security think tank in Santiago called Athena Lab.
The problem was that they were not getting inside the country through the customs services, but through these crossing paths.
There are more than 100 illegal routes along Chile's northern border.
And those crossing paths are very difficult to control because of the geography of the place.
Lizana says many of these informal border crossings are at 16,000 feet above sea level. Law enforcement officials have not been trained to work in those conditions. Because of this, she says large sections of the border are open, and transnational criminal gangs have taken advantage of that. Raúl Arancibia is the district attorney in the Tarapacá region, near Chile's border with Peru and Bolivia. He tells me that Chilean authorities are now seeing crime that was once extremely rare.
Como por ejemplo el sicariato, la extorsión.
He says extortion, contract killings, human trafficking and sexual exploitation are now a problem. Arancibia says the government was not prepared to deal with this kind of criminal activity. That's why Chilean authorities are deploying the military to border areas. Soldiers will now be in charge of checking IDs, searching luggage and arresting criminal suspects. This is good news, says Gerardo Espíndola. He's the mayor of Arica, a city that sits right on the border with Peru. For the first time, the state is regaining control over the border that until now was in the hands of criminals, the mayor tells me. But some say this measure is not going to work. Cristian Doña Rebeco is an expert on immigration in Chile at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. He says sending the military is a waste of resources.
There's not a border guard in Chile as in other countries. It is the police, the same police that you find in the street of any city, are the ones who are trained to be in the borders. The military is not trained to deal with this kind of crime.
And he says the army is also not going to deter people from trying to enter Chile without permission.
Militarization of borders doesn't really work in deterring immigrants. What it only does is it sends migrants to more dangerous routes.
And that, he says, benefits human traffickers. The decision to militarize the border was made by President Gabriel Boric, and it came as a surprise to many people. The 37-year-old leftist leader generally portrays himself as a progressive who supports a humane approach on migration. Cristian Doña Rebeco says his decision to deploy the army has a lot to do with politics.
The current government doesn't have a significant approval rate, and crime and migrants are always the easy targets. If you show that you're strong against migrants, you're strong against crime, even though the results might not be as direct or clear-cut, that might have a positive impact in how you are seen by the public.
Right now, organized crime and migration are on the minds of many Chileans, and a lot of people want to see security as a top priority. Pilar Lizana, the security expert, says that doesn't just mean only responding through law enforcement. She says Chile needs to work with other countries and institutions to control its borders. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. When U.S. officials talk about national security threats, they put China at the top of the list. The head of the Senate Intelligence Committee recently said that China is, and I quote, racing to overtake the United States in a range of emerging and foundational technologies. U.S. law enforcement had already been taking new steps against espionage and intellectual property theft at American research institutions. Those measures are putting some researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology on edge. From the GBH newsroom in Boston, Kirk Carapeza reports.
In September, inside a small MIT conference room, FBI agents pulled down blackout shades and lectured dozens of researchers about rogue nations like Russia, Iran, and especially China. MIT scientist Yoel Fink says the upshot was this.
You need to know that there may very well may be spies on campus, and you need to find them.
Agents asked faculty to vet their foreign research students and staff, something Fink says crossed the line.
Law enforcement should come onto campus only when there is clear evidence of a crime.
MIT administrators appear to be following new national security guidelines. They were first announced by the Trump administration, now being implemented under the Biden administration, and they're supposed to ramp up security in research labs to protect them from international espionage. In addition to on-campus FBI briefings, professors who receive federal funding must also sign new disclosure forms. The goal is vet students to make sure they're not involved in suspicious activities linked to foreign governments. Kristen West is with the Council on Governmental Relations. It represents more than 200 top U.S. research institutions. And she says what's happening at MIT is just the start and a sign of what's to come elsewhere.
If you get federally funded research dollars, yes, it will absolutely be coming to you soon if it's not there already.
Law enforcement officials say intellectual property theft is a problem, costing the U.S. an estimated $200 billion a year. But Kristen West says these new guidelines could discourage talented global researchers from even coming to American universities.
Professors are just going to say, this is too much trouble, puts me at too much risk. I'm just not going to bother with international collaborations anymore. And that hurts science. That hurts our competitiveness.
MIT would not confirm the FBI's visits to its campus this fall, saying only that there are occasional exchanges between researchers and various federal agencies on topics of mutual interest. But that document professors are asked to sign? MIT began asking researchers who receive funding from the Energy Department to sign it at the end of last year. It asked them to make, quote, reasonable inquiry of their students and staff to determine if they've been recruited by a foreign government as a spy.
I think the whole genesis of this is to make sure that American taxpayer dollars fund American research and researchers.
U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm defended these measures on a recent trip to Massachusetts, saying the focus is not on brilliant foreign researchers from around the world or the Chinese diaspora.
Our grievance is with the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party, and making sure that America can be competitive and can be a leader.
MIT researchers acknowledge the threat is real, but they say the recent changes have created a climate of fear and even paranoia.
I'm not trained to do reasonable inquiry.
Gabriella Schlock-Cohen teaches physical chemistry at MIT and says she was surprised when her chair asked her to sign a new disclosure statement. After consulting with an attorney, she's refusing to sign it.
My goal is to educate my students, not to interrogate them.
It's unclear what the repercussions are for researchers who refuse to sign. Inside his fabrics lab, Yoel Fink teaches high-tech weaving. He says suspicion of spying is hurting the fragile global research ecosystem here.
It really undermines the foundation of truth-seeking, of research.
An ecosystem, he says, built on trust. For The World, Kirk Carapeza, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The Great Wall of China, the Forbidden City, the Chinese Terracotta Army, just a few of the things foreign tourists flock to in China, or used to flock to. That was before pandemic travel restrictions were put in place 3 years ago. But that is about to change. China announced this week that it's lifting those restrictions on tourism. Joining me to talk about how this could impact China is Mei Zhang. She's the founder of the Wild China Travel Agency and a fellow with the Aspen Institute. Mei joins us from Berkeley, California. Mei, you're a native of China and you're a travel agent, curator. How excited are you about the news that after 3 years, foreign visitors will be returning to China?
Oh my God. I spoke to my friends. Everyone was elated. We've been waiting for this for 3 years. So for us, it's very, very important, both on a personal level and business level. Of course, you know, tourism has been the hardest hit sector by the pandemic, and everyone knows all the cruise ships and all the cross-border travels shut down. And so, yeah, this is the light that we've been waiting for. And we hope the sun stays out.
Any worries about demand exceeding supply? Like vacation destinations on things like cruise ships are booming right now with pent-up demand. Do you expect the same thing in China?
I think actually it will take a little bit time for the sudden surge. In fact, I think there won't be a sudden surge. I think it will be a gradual return to normalcy. The reason being, China is a long-haul destination. It's far away, and it's very foreign in terms of cultural and language. So most of the travelers that my colleagues have worked with, they know the travelers plan a trip to China with quite a bit lead time, at least 6 months to a year's lead time. We're talking about clients coming from the U.S.
Well, I mentioned at the top the Great Wall of China, the Forbidden City. I mean, I can imagine that's where a lot of tourists want to go first. But where do you think tourists should go first? Like, give me an abbreviated Meizhong Wild China tour.
Right. So you want to arrive in Beijing and see the Forbidden City and see the Great Wall. And you want to end in Shanghai because Shanghai is just so vibrant and so much sort of reflecting the future of where China is headed. I really recommend someone to take a good week, solidly staying in one of the provinces, not rushing around over all these sites too much. Maybe staying in Xi'an and Chengdu, that area, that's very close. And even though it's two provinces, but it's already connected by a high-speed rail, you can see the Terracotta Warrior, you can see the pandas, for the ones who are looking for China as once-in-a-lifetime trip. But for the ones who think they have a little more time to adventure deeper, spend a whole week in Yunnan. That's my hometown. It's beautiful. The ethnic communities there, the flowers. It's China's kingdom of flora and fauna.
I am hooked already.
Come with me.
I'd love to. The U.S.-China relationship has been in a difficult place in recent years. How do you think the return of American tourists to China can play a role in maybe flipping the script?
I would say tourism, a people-to-people level cultural exchange over food, over, you know, sports, running, hiking, outdoor adventures are probably the most important grassroots exchange. And at this day and age, when there is, you know, so much uncertainty on the front page of New York Times or whatever, I think travel is crucial. It is the one bridge that will connect us, hopefully solidly, for a long time.
Meizhong is the founder of the Wild China Travel Agency and a China Fellow with the Aspen Institute. She joined us from Berkeley, California. Thank you very much for speaking with us, May.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. It's still winter in North America, but scientists are detecting heat waves at the bottom of the ocean. Historically, it's been hard to measure the deep sea.
Some of these instruments are destroyed by the ocean, right? It's a powerful thing. The ocean beats up these instruments. We have to service them regularly. It's just an expensive, expensive endeavor.
What new technology is telling us about a warming ocean floor? Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 20 years ago this week, people in Iraq were on edge. It was clear that the United States was about to lead an invasion to bring down Saddam Hussein. What followed in the years after that invasion was a military occupation and a lot of bloodshed. During that time, there was not a lot of space for things like art and music. Today, though, the country is in a much different place. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story from Baghdad.
On a recent Saturday night, Iraqi musicians are performing works by French composer Camille Saint-Saëns at Baghdad's National Theater. The auditorium is packed. Iraqis, young and old, men and women, hijabi and non-hijabi, fill up rows of seats. Tonight, the renowned Iraqi cellist and conductor Karim Wasfi is leading the performance. He got international attention back in 2015 when he played his cello at the site of a suicide bombing in Baghdad. Music has had an important place in Iraqi culture throughout history, but years of war, sectarian violence, and the rise of ISIS disrupted performances and forced many musicians to flee. Now, Iraq is relatively calmer, and music is once again thriving. 26-year-old Zahra Malek is attending the performance tonight with her mother and friends. I meet up with her outside.
For the last 50 years, Iraq has been in war after war. So that's why I think we are fortunate to have such luxuries as music.
Malek grew up in Baghdad during a turbulent time. After the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, different ethnic and religious groups, mainly Shia and Sunnis, fought for power in Iraq. Car bombs ripped through the city on a daily basis.
I confronted several bombings in Baghdad. Every single Iraqi confronted several bombings in Baghdad while growing and living in Iraq, in Baghdad especially.
Every time she left home for school, she says, she wasn't sure if she would get kidnapped. One time, the violence came very close to home.
I was in my school, and like in the door of my school, there was a car that was bombed, and a lot of people got killed in it.
Till this day, she says, she can hear in her head the loud bang from that day.
I was just a child, and in the primary school, I thought that I'm gonna die. I just want to see my parents. I left my books everywhere. It was like a hard thing for a child to consume.
The constant preoccupation with survival made it almost impossible to focus on anything else, she tells me. Her father wouldn't let her leave home on her own. He insisted that the whole family sticks together.
Because he says that if we would go out and we die, we will die together.
Malek says Iraq feels much safer these days, but the stability seems fragile. That's why she and her family are here to savor every moment of the concert tonight. At a small studio on the other side of town, a group of young Iraqis get ready to practice the oud. That's a pear-shaped stringed instrument, similar to a lute. It's key to a lot of Middle Eastern music. Just as the group is about to start, suddenly the power cuts out. This happens every day in Baghdad.
Do you have candles?
No, we don't have candles, actually.
Cell phones come in handy. The students quickly place one in each corner of the studio, and the little bright dots light up the room.
My name is Mustafa Rashid. I'm 32. I'm a media consultant and I play oud.
Rashid is one of 50 oud players in a band called the Peace Orchestra. It's been holding concerts all over Iraq in the past year. He says he learned English while working for different American companies and NGOs. In his time with the Americans, he says, he's been surprised about the image some of them have of Iraq.
Guys, we're not living on the desert. We're not riding camels, we're riding cars. And we have museums, we have theaters, we have the river here.
In 2013, Rashid thought about leaving Iraq, like his two brothers who live in Finland.
I was trying to apply, actually, for one of the immigration programs, but then I thought about my family. I can't leave them, and I love this country. I want to be part of the success of this country.
Rashid says he's hopeful about the future. Sure, Iraq still has many problems, like its forever dysfunctional politics. But overall, he's optimistic.
I think it's secured, more secured right now. There's no bombs. We can live with this.
After decades of conflict, concert halls are once again filling up and music lessons are happening, despite the regular blackouts. And Iraqis like Mustafa Rashid and Zahra Malek are hoping this relative calm continues. So instead of car bombs and gunfire, the sounds of chansons and the oud continue to echo through the city. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Baghdad, Iraq.
The ocean floor is one of the coldest, darkest places on Earth. But according to scientists, it's getting warmer. A new study out this week in the journal Nature Communications finds that the bottom of the ocean has been experiencing heat waves, and that impacts more than those dark, inhospitable places way deep down in the sea. I'm joined by scientist Dylan Amaya, who led the research at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Dylan, what is a bottom marine heat wave? I mean, it's not necessarily hot down there, but is it hotter than usual?
Yeah, it's certainly hotter than usual. A bottom marine heat wave is an anomalous warming, an extreme anomalous warming of any parcel of water in the ocean. So you can technically define a marine heat wave anywhere, including in the Arctic Ocean, for example. It may be very cold there, but it's all relative to where you're at. So if you're at the bottom of the ocean where the temperature could be, you know, anywhere from 5 degrees Celsius to 10 degrees Celsius, an extreme warming for a critter that is used to those water temperatures, you know, it could just be 12 degrees Celsius. It may sound cold to us, but that extra 2 degrees warming is a lot for a critter that's adapted to those water temperatures.
And what causes them?
So that's actually an open question on our end. It's something that we're actively researching within our lab groups. But we have some pretty good ideas and some decent hypotheses for what may be driving marine heat waves at the bottom of the ocean that could be related to changes in ocean currents and the ways in which they're moving warm water around. It could be related to mixing of warm water from the surface down to the bottom of the water column.
What was the geographic scope of your study? Where were you looking?
We were primarily focused on the coastal waters surrounding North America, but this is broadly applicable to anywhere in the world. Bottom marine heat waves almost certainly happen, you know, around the coasts of Australia or in the Mediterranean Sea, where other people have been looking at marine heat waves. But this has just been sort of the first time that we're trying to peel back those layers and really see it in a more detailed way.
So I want to get back to the causes. You said that's still unclear, but what is the possible connection to climate change?
So this is an interesting question, right? We know for sure that marine heat waves are getting warmer everywhere around the world, basically. Definitely at the surface, throughout the water column, and certainly along the bottom, along continental shelves, that the absolute temperature of these phenomena are becoming warmer. And that's driven by, you know, human-induced changes in greenhouse gases, which is driving global warming, and that extra heat is getting mixed into the ocean where it's manifesting itself in these extreme events. What's a little less clear, and it's more of an open research question, is whether the event itself, the actual physical phenomena of a marine heat wave, is becoming more frequent or more intense. And that's a little bit more of a nuance, but it is an important question, and it is something that we're actively researching.
So I'm curious to know what impacts deep ocean heat waves would have on the rest of the world, like fisheries or algal blooms.
Yeah, so fisheries certainly feel the effects of these bottom marine heat waves. I think maybe the most familiar impact that people may be used to thinking about is this idea of coral bleaching. But maybe a little closer to home around North America, the Gulf of Alaska experienced a drastic decline in the Pacific cod fishery around 2015 in response to a marine heat wave, something like a 70% decline, and that's a $100 million fishery, so it's a big deal.
So I'm interested to know what your concern is about deep ocean heat waves. I mean, are you seeing this heat like rising up and impacting coral and other marine life that we might have thought before was only being impacted by surface heat?
Yeah, I think our main concern with bottom marine heat waves is that they can happen without any surface signature. And often our most reliable and most consistent observations of the ocean are happening at the surface. So there's the very real possibility that these bottom marine heat waves are happening without us even knowing. It could really be the fact that we don't know they happen until the ecological impacts are apparent. And so that's the main concern here, is that we can't plan for them because often we don't know that they're happening.
Why is it so hard to study temperatures at the bottom of the ocean?
Yeah, it's really difficult to study temperatures at the bottom of the ocean because we don't have a ton of observations down there, historically speaking. We have some instruments that have been there for a while, but some of these instruments are destroyed by the ocean, right? It's a powerful thing. The ocean beats up these instruments. We have to service them regularly. It's just an expensive, expensive endeavor. We have some new tools to study these things, but that historically has limited our ability to understand what's going on at the bottom of the ocean because we just haven't had great observations.
Dylan Amaya is a research scientist at NOAA. He joined us from Boulder, Colorado, and was speaking with us about bottom ocean heat waves. Dylan, thanks very much.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me.
As soon as the Taliban took control of Kabul in August of 2021, they began cracking down on Afghan media organizations. Most news websites were quickly banned. Many Afghan journalists were forced to leave the country. Some are now working in exile. Reporter Valerie Plesch spent time with staff from an independent Afghan newspaper at their new office in Silver Spring, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C.
On the 9th floor of an old cement office building named the World Building is a small but spacious office. A team of Afghan journalists is working here in exile. The three rooms where the staff work from overlook the main street in downtown Silver Spring, across from an Ethiopian restaurant and a tobacco shop.
Hi, Zaki. How are you?
Good, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Zaki Darabi is the founder and publisher of Ateletros, a leading investigative newspaper in Afghanistan. He started it in 2012, and it has grown in size since then, going online in 2013 and launching Kabul Now, an English-language news website. The popular daily newspaper was circulated throughout Kabul until the last print edition came out on August 15, 2021, the day the Taliban entered and captured Kabul.
And I feel like after 10 years, my biggest dream and responsibility is to keep Ateletros alive.
In the days leading up to the fall of Kabul and in the immediate aftermath, Darabi coordinated with his big team of journalists to keep on working as safely as they could.
Even what's happening in the coming days, if the government is going to fall, then we should work together to continue our work and to continue Ateletros and to save this platform, this newspaper that we have been fighting for over a decade.
But that soon proved to be too dangerous.
And unfortunately, there are a lot of restrictions just come, and then we felt a lot of problem. Our colleagues have been tortured by the Taliban.
One of those journalists was his own younger brother, Taki, who was detained and severely beaten by the Taliban while filming a woman's protest with another reporter in downtown Kabul, less than a month after the takeover. Taki calls the beating an accident.
Yes, that accident keeps me enough strong to keep going, not giving up, so.
Photos of Taki Darabi's abuse were widely shared by the media, and he still suffers from nightmares. After the incident with his brother, Zaki Darabi says the Taliban's intelligence agency was asking for him to come to their office to talk. He knew what that meant.
And I didn't go because I realized that they will take me to the prison.
The brothers managed to evacuate from Afghanistan in October 2021 and resettle in Maryland. An hour after they flew out of Kabul, the Taliban surrounded Darabi's office and searched for him everywhere, asking his team for his home address. Today, his journalists are spread around the world, from California to Spain to Turkey. Last summer, Darabi built his team again.
Fortunately, I could bring some of my colleagues here in Silver Spring,
including his brother Taki, who edits videos for the website and social media from the new office in Maryland.
I don't wish it happened to others, so that's why we should keep going on and try to do as much as we can do and tell these stories and let others know about Afghanistan, what's happening in Afghanistan. So.
The journalists are discussing the latest report from a government watchdog on Afghanistan that just came out. They're in regular contact with the reporters in Afghanistan, around 35 of them, who must work anonymously as the Taliban have targeted them and the newspaper. Most of the journalists in Maryland don't even know the names of their colleagues working in Afghanistan. Zaki Darabi says that readership has significantly increased over the last 2 years and that they are publishing more articles now compared to before the fall from more areas in Afghanistan.
We definitely have seen since the Taliban takeover, you know, that it has had a devastating effect on the media landscape in Afghanistan.
That's Bayi Lei, Asia Program Coordinator from the Committee to Protect Journalists. She says that it's become almost impossible for journalists to do independent reporting. Some have been forced to work for Taliban-affiliated media that took over their newsrooms.
Media outlets are fighting censorship every day.
That's why residents are relying on Ateletros. Assad, who didn't want us to say his full name, lives in Kabul and reads Ateletros regularly. He says he follows Ateletros because it publishes the reality in Afghanistan, which he sees every day and everywhere with his own eyes. There are a few other journalists trying to freelance or work for international NGOs, but it's very dangerous. I spoke to one who didn't want to use his name.
Yes, it's very difficult for journalists in. But we ambition, you know, we hope to finish this problem because we also Afghan people, and if we're not working for our country, we cannot improve this problem we have in Afghanistan.
Back in Silver Spring, Darabi continues to look for ways to evacuate his family and colleagues who remain in Afghanistan. he reflects on what has been achieved over the last 20 years.
Freedom of expression, the independent media, and this brave journalists are working from Afghanistan or outside Afghanistan. One of the biggest achievements of that country.
Darabi relies solely on grants to fund Atelet Ruz, and he says there's no guarantee how long he'll be able to run the site. His vision is to expand the news site into a company that can collaborate with other media outlets around the world to share reports from Afghanistan. For now, his focus is to keep the flow of information from Afghanistan alive. For The World, I'm Valerie Plesch in Silver Spring, Maryland.
In Ghana and West Africa, there is a shortage of some fairly common vaccines. It's left many children without the protection they need against certain deadly diseases. Health officials in Ghana blame pandemic-related supply chain disruptions. A lack of resources for immunization programs, that's also adding to the problem. From Ghana's capital, Accra, we have this report from Ridwan Karim Dini Osman.
At the pediatric section of the Mamoubi Hospital in Accra, Comfort Tete has just finished weighing her four-week-old baby, and she straps him on her back. She tells me he is her fifth child, and he has not taken any vaccine since he was born. Typically, during visits like this, newborns are immunized against several killer childhood diseases.
They say we should wait and then see if it will come, maybe next month or so. So I'll try, keep trying until I get for him.
Tete has been roaming from one health facility to the other, but to no avail.
We are still hoping that we will get for our children so that nothing will go wrong with them.
Elsewhere at the Greater Accra Regional Hospital, Janet Kwee paces about while gently patting the back of her one-year-old baby, whom she is holding close to her chest. After visiting about three hospitals, her baby only received one shot out of the many routine vaccines here. Kwee is frustrated by the long walks in the sun.
Carrying the baby from here, there, and it's not even healthy for the child as well.
And the transport costs are draining her meager savings.
For me like this, I'm not staying around here. So if I have come all the way from that place and then you have to take only one shot and have to look for another hospital to go for another shot, it's really a problem.
She is worried her baby might catch an infection before the vaccine arrives. Vaccines against tuberculosis, polio, measles, hepatitis B are among those currently in serious short supply in Ghana. The COVID-19 pandemic and associated disruptions have strained health systems, with 25 million children missing out on vaccination in 2021. Although manufacturing capacity worldwide has increased, it remains highly concentrated in developed countries.
Just that discrepancy on its own exacerbates access, especially to those that are poor and marginalized within the global south.
That's Nigel James, a global health policy researcher at Pennsylvania State University. He says that limited supply and unequal distribution is continuing to drive global disparities. James says world leaders should take pragmatic steps to guarantee equitable access to vaccines for people everywhere.
Everybody who is involved in the global supply chain for vaccines needs to understand and realize that vaccines are only as effective to the extent that we are able to get them to the people that require them. No one is safe until we are all protected.
The Ghanaian government has attributed the current shortages to procurement bottlenecks and steady global decline in supply of childhood vaccines. President Nana Akufo-Addo says the situation will soon be fixed, but doesn't give specific timelines.
In accordance with our desire not to become part of this global trend, government has taken steps to ensure the stocks of these vaccines are procured and supplied as a matter of urgency and emergency.
But in the meantime, there is a dangerous measles outbreak developing in the country. Measles is very contagious and cases tend to show up quickly when vaccination levels decline. in the wake of the vaccine shortage, over 100 cases of measles have been confirmed nationwide, with almost 600 suspected cases being investigated in northern Ghana alone. Dr. John Adebiapia is president of the Pediatric Society of Ghana. He is concerned the situation, if not urgently fixed, could erode Ghana's gains in reducing under 5 mortality.
Measles has both acute and then post-acute long-term complications. Our fear is the long-term complications. It can cause brain damage. It can cause slow growth. It can cause malnutrition. If we allow this to fester on, the poorer the outlook will be for the nation.
The Pediatric Society also wants the government to, among other measures, settle on a dedicated source of funding for childhood vaccines to avert future crises. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Only about 150,000 people in the world speak Maori. Most are the indigenous people of New Zealand. And yet there's news today that the Oxford English Dictionary is going to include 47 new entries in Maori in its latest updated edition. Maori is an endangered language, so this is good news. But it took some work to get here.
Have a go. Be brave. Say the word. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Like this 2018 ad from the New Zealand government, helping visitors understand one basic expression, kia ora, one of the new dictionary entries. It does not have a perfect equivalent in English. Kia ora is a greeting that connotes friendship and respect for the person you meet. These days in New England, many non-Indigenous people say kia ora. In that context, it amounts to hello, mate. You might hear it when you walk into a shop. The Maori language, Te Reo Maori, also got a boost from the former Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. Here she is at an official dinner of Commonwealth Nations at Buckingham Palace in 2018, where she busted out her best Te Reo Maori.
In New Zealand, there is a Maori proverb, he aha te mea nui o te ao. What is the most important thing in the world? He tangata, he tangata, he tangata. It is the people, the people, the people.
Good language modeling from leaders gets attention. When Disney's animated feature Moana came out in 2016 with its fictional Polynesian title character on a quest for self-discovery, a special Te Reo Maori version of the movie was produced for the Maori people in New Zealand. Ko Awa Moana, the title of that song, translates from Maori as I am Moana. One word that is not making its way into the Oxford English Dictionary is Poro Poro Aki. That means goodbye, and it's where we leave you on this Wednesday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GVH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online at theworld.org. Thanks for making it today. Poro Poro Aki, everyone.